This is Car Expert.
There are no other cars that can come close to 0 to 100 in 2.1, and that's a family car. Is there something wrong with that, or am I barking up the wrong tree here?
I don't know how the engineers do it. Honestly, leaves pretty much every other brand in the dust.
This feels like the Outback of old. It hasn't tried to evolve into something that it's not.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and joining me this week, James Wong. Hello.
Hi, Mandy. It's so nice to be called up first.
I'm going backwards this week from W to C. Hello, Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy. Thank you for remembering how to spell my surname.
I was going to say your surname is an S, but like, no, hang on, we call you Scully, so it just totally did my head in. How great is this video? We were talking about this last week of the new platform that Zencastr has where we can see each other. I see Joe has a new haircut. Looks awesome.
Thank you. I'm not sure about lighting, though, because the lighting in here is not very good.
So you've got some, for our listeners, you've got some blonde tips in, and you've had a lot, almost like your lockdown hair cut off.
Yeah, well, the blonde and which became a brown, which then went back to sort of a honey blonde as it faded out, was getting
a
little
kaleidoscope.
Bit, yeah, it was. I appreciated the styling, but it was getting too hard to manage. I've got very unruly hair at the best of times, so I thought I'd chop it all off and start again. So, yes.
Do you like the interior of my Volkswagen Up? Because I'm currently doing the podcast in my daily driver, which is
it looks
cool.
I've never actually sat in an Up. You'll have to take me for a drive in at one time, yeah.
Well, if I lean forward, you can actually see the words Up written on the backrest somewhere.
That's
here.
A really cool seat too. It's like a racing seat.
Yeah, it's one piece, and it's I think it's fake leather, but it's lasting really well. It's got white piping and, yeah, the words Up on it. And like for a 9-year-old car, it's dating rather well.
The really cool thing VW did with that Up is they, rather than put a big infotainment system in, they just said, here's the basics, bring your own phone. And it at the time might have come across as a little bit stingy, but in 2021, I think that's the year, it just means you can have the latest phone plugged into the top of the dashboard and you're flying. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Or you're like me and just keep the optional Maps and More Navigon system, which is terrible because it is so out of date now. I don't even use the GPS. And the Bluetooth is absolutely terrible as well because I can hear my caller or the person I'm talking to, but all they hear from my end is white noise.
Okay.
So I just give up with the Bluetooth. And the only thing I really use it for is the temperature and fuel economy reading. That's about it. But it does its job. Does its job. Scully, you've been driving a much more luxurious car than my Up this week, the Mercedes-Benz S-Class. How did you find it?
Yeah, so didn't get to drive, unfortunately. It was parked in a very nice event space in South Melbourne, and they would have been very annoyed if I'd crashed through the windows in the new S-Class. but, yeah, Mercedes is getting ready to launch the car in Australia. It's announced pricing, and that will be live on the site by the time this podcast goes live. It's obviously not cheap. You got to pay at least $240,000 to get into one. So it's not a Volkswagen Up competitor, but what it is very, very impressive in person. Awesome. The two cars that we had a sit in were both long wheelbase cars, and the space in the back is massive. It's like being in a business class seat, which is, yeah, difficult to do, especially given it's not that much bigger than the old S-Class. But beyond that, like the new MBUX system is just incredible to look at. That vertical touchscreen we had a bit of a play with, and it's got haptic feedback now, which means it clicks when you press stuff, which is welcome. But the really impressive thing was the 3D driver display. Genesis has been doing this for a little while now, and I know other brands are playing with it, but like the 3D effect you get is kind of trippy when the navigation's set up. You sit there and it's like looking at a hologram almost, poking out of the dashtop screen. You don't have to wear red and blue glasses, which is a positive as well. But, yeah, like any true S-Class, it really feels like Mercedes has tried to push the game forward as far as possible. And all the cars in Australia do come with some pretty cool kit too. The long wheelbase gets a new rear airbag as standard, gets that 3D cluster as standard, and a whole lot of driver assistance tech on top of the vaunted S-Class badge. So, yeah, it was pretty cool to see up close and personal.
When are we going to get it through the garage so we can drive it?
I'm not quite sure. I think Mercedes is planning to roll the car out over the next couple of months. So I'm going to be like a car brand PR here and say in the second quarter of 2021.
That sounds about right. Let's get stuck into this week's news. The 2021 Ram 1500 TRX, it is coming to Australia, Scully, but we still don't have pricing yet.
We don't. So just for a quick refresher, the Ram 1500 TRX is Ram's Ford Ranger Raptor killer. It's got a supercharged V8 engine. It's got some incredible specs. It'll do 0 to 60 miles an hour in 4.5 seconds, and you're doing 160 k's an hour in just 10.5 seconds. So it's a pretty serious truck for something that is the size of a small village. We've known that it's coming to Australia for a little while. There's a company in Queensland that actually converts these already, but the sort of official importer, Ateco Australia, which works with Walkinshaw in Clayton to convert these cars to right-hand drives based on specs and information provided by Ram head office in the US, has wanted this car, and we've sort of known that it's probably going to come officially from the factory. Now it turns out that orders are kind of sort of open if you know a dealer and you're in a real hurry. So there's a box on the website on Ram Australia saying that if you have a really keen interest, you can sign up and you'll get notification when pricing and that sort of thing comes out. But we kind of know now that dealers have actually started taking deposits from customers who want to lock down their place in the queue. Obviously, if you are really, really keen for this car and you absolutely have to have it and you absolutely can't wait, I'd be going and talking to my dealer, because even though we're expecting it to cost like between $170,000 and $180,000, it does seem like demand is going to be pretty high. Australia loves its Utes, it loves its Ram, and this is the meanest Ram you can buy. So yeah, at the moment, it's still not quite clear what it'll cost and when it'll arrive. But if you want one, I'd already be getting a little bit pushy and going and talking to my dealer.
It sounds like people have too much money.
I mean, there are worse problems to have, aren't there?
Well, yes.
And too much need for power, like 4.5 seconds to 100 k's an hour. Who needs that much power?
In that kind of vehicle as well. Like, imagine if you've got stuff in the back and like an entire pallet just falls out of the tailgate or something.
Or your dog or something.
Yeah, not thank you.
I do think the cool thing with the TRX is, and Ram actually already kind of used this in its ad campaign, but there are a million Hiluxes, Rangers, Ranger Raptors on the road already. But if you were to pull up at the lights in a TRX, there is very little else in Australia that could look eye to eye with you, for one, because it is so damn massive. And then there's very little else that'll be able to keep up with you as well. So if you want bragging rights, there is nothing else that'll match it.
Yeah, it's definitely very cool.
It certainly is. Hey, another thing that's really cool too, and quick, the Defender 2022, the Land Rover V8, we have pricing for that one, Scully. Is it just as quick as the TRX?
It isn't. So even though it's got a 5-litre supercharged V8 with 386 kilowatts and 625 newton metres of torque, the Defender 90, which is the 3-door version, is getting the V8 as well as the 110. It'll do 0 to 100 in 5.2 seconds, and flat out you're doing 240 k's an hour. I realise those are just hot hatch numbers from a car with enough power to like reorient the earth. But if you really think about it, the Defender is very big and very heavy, and it kind of has the aerodynamic profile of a very pretty brick. So you can understand why, even though it is powerful, it's not the quickest thing in the world. I kind of don't care. I don't care that it's slower than a G-Wagon in a straight line. I don't care that you'd get smoked by a Civic Type R driven well. Because, I mean, for one, you look at it and it looks really, really cool. It rides on these matte black wheels. It's got pale blue brake calipers, which is interesting. I didn't know that that was a thing Jaguar Land Rover did, but certainly stands out against the matte black. And there's just something so cool about the idea of a Defender 93 door with a giant V8 engine. It is expensive though. It does seem like Jaguar and Land Rover know that people are going to want this car. You can get a Jaguar F-Pace SUV with the same engine for about $140,000. The Defender 90, the smaller one, costs $200,450. And the 110 costs $205,500. So, yeah, if you do want one of these cars, then to arrive in about July, I would start saving right now.
That's crazy.
That's so cool.
Are they limited numbers?
So it's a full-time member of the range, as far as I understand. It's not like a works car or a restoration car, because previously Land Rover has put a V8 in the old Defender. But it was a very expensive sort of special works car for customers who who had a lot of money and a real like nostalgic desire to get a V8 Defender, but this is just part of the range, it looks like. It's also come at the same time as some updates for the rest of the Defender range. There's now a new larger screen option for the interior. There's a few new exterior packages, and there's revised pricing for Australia because the six-cylinder diesel range is touching down at the same time as the V8. So that is also live on carexpert.com, but I'm not going to take you through the million variants on the podcast right now.
Are you a fan of the Defender, Joe?
Oh, I am absolutely a huge fan of the Defender. I think it's an amazing looking thing, and I'm a big fan of like the whole like retro modern thing. I think that's really cool, being able to have stuff that sort of harks back to history and heritage but with a modern twist. And I think the new Defender's a really cool combination of like Land Rover old and new. I've just discovered as well that it's got quad tailpipes at the back. That's what? So cool. There's a picture. There's a back picture of the 90 in black, and it's got these like downward facing quad pipes. And I just imagine standing behind that when it accelerates would just be manic.
That's amazing.
They've not like integrated them into a diffuser or a splitter or anything. They've kind of just put them there. So the car stops and there's just four exhaust pipes underneath it. They just kind of hang there. It's really cool.
Yeah. That's so old school. I love it.
I love it. Yeah, me too. Joe, what do we think of the 2021 Mercedes-Benz C-Class? It has been revealed this week.
Yes, I'm actually keen to hear your thoughts, both of y'all, as William Stopford would say, I'm sure. The all-new C-Class has been revealed this week before it touches down here in the fourth quarter of 2021. So what Mercedes tends to do with the C-Class is give it a like mini S-Class look, and I guess that might be why it's so popular, because people like the whole mini-me super luxury vibe that it tends to give off. So the new one looks a lot like the latest S-Class, even in terms of the interior as well. So the headlining changes really are the new design and then the interior with the latest MBUX 2.0 screen, which gets that massive central portrait-style tablet screen, as well as the digital instruments. It's got that new touch-capacitive steering wheel that, Scott, you trialed in the new E-Class, didn't you?
I did, yeah. It looked very cool. I think some work needs to be done on how it operates. I don't think it's a step forward from the last Merc steering wheel, which was mostly proper buttons and then it had a couple of little swipey touchpads. I actually found the new wheel really quite frustrating in the E63. So hopefully Merc is working away in the background to tweak that software, because that is one thing that, despite all the advances they've made in their interiors, they keep changing and complicating and tweaking, and they're yet to land on the best solution, I think.
Mm. Well, yeah, on the topic of design and everything, just the whole interior seems just really out there. It's very new age. There's a lot of glossy bits. There's a lot of screens. There's a lot of interesting shapes. So I think if people like progressive design, which I feel like a lot of Benz buyers do, which is why we see so many like A-classes on the road right now, because everything's just so space age in terms of all the tech that you've got on offer. So it's a very, very much a baby S-Class. The engine lineup is nothing too surprising. All of the core range will be four-cylinder engines. We've got a range of petrol and diesel models, and we'll probably only get petrol. So you've got C180 and 200 models with a 1.5-litre turbo petrol, and then there's also a C300 with a 2-litre petrol. There will also be a few plug-in hybrids with what Mercedes-Benz is claiming, almost or around 100 kilometres of electric range, which is nuts. And then also there'll also be petrol and diesel plug-in hybrids. So Mercedes has an interesting habit of doing both petrol and diesel plug-in hybrids. We don't tend to get the diesel ones here. We did for a very short period of time. I'm pretty sure there was one iteration of C-Class plug-in hybrid that was a diesel, not a petrol. But then they stopped doing that. So yeah, it's a bit longer, it's a bit wider, it's a bit lower. The new wagon looks quite cool. I think it's the way that the roof line is a bit more conventional and it sort of feeds into the rear taillight design a little bit better. But it's not a total departure from what the current car is. So if you look at William's story. At the end, we've got one of those sliders that shows the new car over the old car. And if you look at the overall shape and lines and everything, it's still very similar. But obviously with the new corporate design front and rear. So I guess it won't burn current owners who might think that the interior or the exterior a bit much for them, but it also might attract new people who might find the current one a bit long in the tooth now. But yeah, so we're looking forward to seeing them in person, because sometimes these designs, when they're quite flashy and different in images, they can look really different in person. And I found that with a lot of Mercedes designs, especially of late, when you see them in pictures, you might go, oh, the front looks a bit flat, or it looks a bit stubby or a bit odd and from certain angles. And then you see it in person and it looks much better. So I'm sure we're going to see a lot of these on Australian roads soon, because people here love the C-Class. It was long the sales leader in that medium luxury sedan segment. And I'm sure this new model with all the fancy screens and everything, which makes Audi and BMW look old school, I'm sure we're going to see a lot of those.
Do we want to speculate what the price will be?
I imagine it won't be too much more than what the current one is, but then again, Benz has been increasing their prices lately. So I think the current range starts from about low to mid 60s. So I would say, you know, at lowest, we might see like mid to high 60s for a base C180 or C200, and then it will climb all the way through to around 90, 100 for a C300 with everything in it. We'll have to wait and see.
Sounds about right.
Yes.
And lastly, Scully, the 2021 Hyundai Ioniq 5 has been revealed.
It has, and it looks just like the concept, which is rare but exciting. This is actually quite a big car for Hyundai, because it launches its new Ioniq sub-brand. We already have the Hyundai Ioniq, which is like a rival to the Toyota Prius. It's available with hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and full electric power. But this new Ioniq sub-brand is what all of the new electric cars will be badged. We've got the 5 at the moment, which is like a mid-sized SUV. It's like a Tucson, essentially. And there's going to be the 6 and the 7 coming in the next couple of years as well. And this is how Hyundai wants to take on Tesla. It's how it wants to take on Volkswagen ID. It's built on a brand new platform, which we've actually talked out on the podcast before. But the production car is available with a 58 kilowatt hour and a 72.6 kilowatt hour battery. The maximum range is about 480 kilometers on the WLTP test cycle with the rear-wheel drive large battery car. And the fastest model will do 0 to 100 in about 5 seconds. So if you're in an Ioniq 5, you're actually going to smoke a Defender V8 off the lights, which is not how I would have guessed that drag race would have gone, having looked at the two cars. I think the really cool thing about this Ioniq is it is a pure electric car from the ground up. So at the moment, what Hyundai is doing with its electric cars is the Kona and the Ioniq are both built on conventional, like, internal combustion platforms. And that means that the interiors are quite normal. It means that there's no space under the bonnet for storage. It means they look like the Kona, and the Ioniq is like a slightly shrunken Prius. But the Ioniq 5 has a 3,000 millimeter wheelbase, which is actually longer than the Palisade's wheelbase, I believe. And it's only 4625 millimeters long. So it's Tucson size with a Palisade wheelbase. And what that means is you can have a heap of space inside, because the passengers have lots of legroom. The floor is completely flat. And there's still a 531 litre boot, 1600 litres when you fold the seats flat, and a 60 litre space under the bonnet as well. The interior itself looks really, really cool too. There's like a sliding center console, and you can slide it back for rear passengers to give them more USB ports, or slide it forward to make the car like a walk-through center console. I think the idea being, if you've got kids in the back that want to get out the front, or if you've got passengers on one side of the car and they need to walk across to get out away from traffic or from a tight door or something like that, they're able to do it. But Hyundai's been able to, you know, take some liberties with this car that it can't take with its current electric cars, because it's actually been designed to be electric from the start. I'm really interested to hear what you guys think, because I'm a huge fan of what's been done here.
You know what, actually, the first impression for me with the design, and this is a compliment, it reminds me of the Audi A3 Sportback, the side design of it all. Yeah, it's awesome looking car, and it looks exactly like a concept. So I am really thrilled that Hyundai decided to go with the concept look. It's going to stand out in the road.
Oh, I'm the same. I remember we covered the concept when it was labeled the 45, when it was revealed at one of the motor shows a couple of years ago, and it looked so cool. And I loved that, again, that sort of retro-inspired modern look, and being in a there was like that one motor show where like Honda revealed the E, and there was a few other electric vehicle concepts that all were sort of designed to ape classic design. So like the Honda E was looked like the original Civic, and then the 45, there was, I think it's the Hyundai Pony or something like
that. It is the Pony, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that, I thought that was really cool. And the proportions and everything have carried over to this production model, and it looks really cool. And I think it's very distinctive, but also quite attractive, because I know that sometimes with these electrified vehicles, the designs can be a little bit too out there for me personally. I like the idea of having an electric or plug-in hybrid that doesn't need to look like a spaceship or a science experiment. So this one sort of is clean, but it's also a little bit you know, forward-thinking and progressive and all that kind of stuff. I just can't believe how bloody huge this thing is. Like 4.6 meters, my parents' Sorento is like nudging 4.7. So it's not that much smaller than that. And it's got a 3,000 millimeter wheelbase. It's almost as long as an S, like the wheelbase is almost as big as like an S-Class. It's just huge.
You can't quite tell how big it is in the photos either. Like it,
no, it,
it
just looks like an oversized
like
hatch.
Exactly, yeah. I can't wait to see it in person.
I think we're going to see some really interesting things with this Hyundai platform. Hyundai's already said that although there will be things in the design that do tie all the cars together, they're all going to look a bit unique. But also we're so used to the proportions of internal combustion cars because they've been fixed for a really long time. Like the designers talk about the dash to axle ratio, for example, about a long front and a short rear deck on a sports car, that sort of thing. And when you look at the Ioniq, your brain goes, that's a small car because the wheels are pushed all the way to the edges of it and all the proportions are kind of the relationship between all the different parts, a small car relationship. But that's just because it's got a really, really long wheelbase because it's electric. I'm really interested to see how Hyundai and Kia take this platform and the freedom it gives them and play around with proportions and what we're used to in car design, because there's so much that can be done. It's just kind of down to someone to actually do it.
Mm. Yeah. Exactly. Well, check out the story and all the other ones we've spoken about today up at carexpert.com.au and click the news link. Hello, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy Turner.
Last week you teased us with the Porsche Taycan, but due to an embargo, you couldn't talk about the driving impressions until now.
Mm-hmm.
Before we do get into that, first, what does the Taycan mean for Porsche?
It means a hell of a lot to Porsche. It's the company's first electric car. And it's not an electrified version of an existing vehicle like we've seen a lot of brands do. It is a ground-up electric vehicle designed to be nothing but. And, you know, this is, I mean, the Volkswagen Group as a whole has basically said that it is going to be a fully electric brand in the very near future, and Porsche is its pinnacle brand. And, you know, when any car company does a new thing, there's a certain degree of pressure. But for Porsche, it's always ramped up, you know, to 11 because Porsche is renowned as being probably the best engineered car brand of them all. So when it turns its hand to some new tech, it bloody well better be good.
Mm. And was it good?
I love this car. I do. And I love pretty much everything about it. I mean, the first things that you see are the service level elements, and that's the looks. I was actually in Europe 5 years ago, or 6 years ago, I should say, when they revealed the Mission E concept car. It was at the enormous, sprawling Frankfurt Motor Show. And in this post-COVID world, that seems like an entire lifetime ago. But I remember them tearing the covers off that concept car and saying, this is going to be what we're going to make. And you thought, there's no way in hell they can make a road car look like this. And in our review on the side, I've done a side-by-side so that you can actually see for yourself just how much this looks like the concept. Aside from the, you know, screwy kind of rear hinged back doors, there's almost no change. It looks superb. It's far more a low stretched four door 911 than it is sort of a Panamera in terms of its design. On the inside, it's quite a different approach for Porsche. They don't use any buttons anymore. It's all screens down to moving the air vent direction is controlled by touchscreen now. So everything's screens. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 screens inside the interior. Massive curved glass in front of you, haptic display for ventilation, center touchscreen, and there's another one in front of the front passenger as well. In typical Porsche style, you sit low, the steering wheel and the position is sort of unmistakable for any other brand. So all those surface level things are great, with the exception of the rear seat room, which you probably expect. Then you get to the actual mechanicals, and this car is something else again. So it's incredibly stiff. The battery is built as a, you know, a fundamental part of the car's structure. It's running an 800-volt electrical system, so it can handle huge amounts of direct current, so 270-kilowatt charging speeds, up to 350 capable, which means you can top it up in about 20 minutes or so using the most rapid chargers on the market. There are three different grades, and the top of the range Turbo S, 560 kilowatts of power on overboost and 1,050 newton meters of torque using launch control. All versions have two motors, one at the front, one at the back. The back motor has a two-speed gearbox. The front motor has a single gearbox, single-speed gearbox. It's got, you know, minute active anti-roll stabilizers, yaw control, air suspension. I mean, Porsche's thrown the kitchen sink at this vehicle. And even the base 4S only takes 4 seconds to get to 100. The top of the range one gets to 100 in just 2.8 seconds. So this is a vehicle that's been designed to perform. And we've seen EVs do performance before, but the Porsche is a much more cohesive kind of experience.
So, Moko, you sort of touched on that there. We know electric cars can accelerate hard. Does the Taycan actually feel like a Porsche when you show it some corners?
For two reasons, it feels like a Porsche. Unlike some electric vehicles, and, you know, we all know electric cars are quick. The fundamental nature of a motor is that it gives you all of its torque instantly. So they always get off the line rapidly. But the Porsche actually handles like a proper Porsche should. The fact that it's a 2.3-ton, 5-meter-long car that handles like this does defy physics, but we've seen before with Porsche, they've created vehicles like the Macan that also seems to defy physics in the way it handles. The ride quality is superb over, you know, acneed, corrugated potholes and things like that. Air suspension does wonders. The chambered air suspension does wonders. And also it seems like it's a proper Porsche in terms of that bulletproof switch watch-like kind of reliability. Porsche has a fun fact where they did 26 consecutive 0 to 200 kilometer an hour launch-controlled acceleration tests. Every single one was under 10 seconds, and the difference between number one and number 26 was less than a second. So, wow. You know, this was the most detailed, exhaustive, in-depth press kit database I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, this is just Porsche saying to its engineers, nerd out, make this as, you know, bloody brilliant as you possibly can. And that really shows in the way this thing drives. The other final one, Scully, is some EVs, you know, as you would know, when you accelerate, they're really quick off the line, but they taper quite quickly as you get up to a higher VMAX, or you approach VMAX, I should say. But the Taycan, because it has that two ratio gearbox at the rear with the overlapping ratios, it actually doesn't taper off. It sort of hammers like a freight train. And I didn't drive this on a track, so I'm not going to say that I was driving 260, which is the VMAX. But you don't feel any sort of relaxation of that torque delivery. So, yeah, in short, noise aside, it drives like a proper Porsche. You can get a fake inducted noise that goes through the cabin to sort of make it sound a little bit like a normal car. I think that's stupid. I think you should just have a Atmo V8 in your garage for the weekend and just embrace the silence. But, you know, if you like that sort of thing, go for it.
How did it ride, Moko?
So well, Mandy. You know, this is on 21-inch wheels and it's, you know, designed to sort of stay perfectly flat in corners, and yet it just soaks up the worst that the Victorian B-roads that I drove it on could throw at it. The NVH was good. It just floats. You know, you sound predictable and you sound like a wanker, but it's true. You drive a Porsche that's a proper Porsche, you know, and not all Porsches fit this bill, but you drive a Porsche that they've really put all the effort into, and the way that it both rides beautifully and handles honestly leaves pretty much every other brand in the dust. I don't know how the engineers do it. It might be witchcraft. It might just be really clever number crunching. But, yeah, it glides better than I hoped that it would.
Beautiful.
Moko, I have probably a left-of-field question because after reading your review and seeing how diverse the range is in a certain way, like you look at the 4S, you look at the Turbo, you look at the Turbo S, there's sort of three very distinct flavors in what is the take, you know, what the Taycan form is. Yeah. Did Porsche sort of say that each variant or, you know, individual model line within the Taycan range is targeting a different kind of buyer?
Well, I know that across the range, they're saying about 50% of buyers are existing Porsche customers who have a 911 GT of some variety and want a daily. And then the other half are electric vehicle enthusiasts who are going to buy the first Porsche. Now, clearly the Turbo S is going to appeal to your rusted-on Porsche guy or lady, whereas the entry-level $190,000 Taycan 4S, which is $40,000 cheaper than even the base 911 Carrera. It's probably the one that's going to appeal to sort of the new potential Porsche buyer because it lines up beautifully against a updated Model S plate from Tesla. Not quite as quick as that vehicle, but I would argue engineered with a greater amount of handling depth. So I think it's quite clear that you're going to get a pretty diverse buyer lineup, like you say, Wongy. And especially at the entry level, I think it's a whole new customer that Porsche is probably going to lure.
Which one would you buy?
Well, I mean, money no object, obviously the Turbo S. But at the end of the day, the Turbo S is $340,000 before on roads. The Turbo is $270,000 and the base one's $190,000. And the Turbo S does not feel like twice the car the base one is. And it's the case of, you know, the people that buy the top of the line Porsche, they just have to have the top of the line and they'll pay whatever they got to pay because they just got to have it, right? People like Alborz. But somewhere in the middle, the Turbo gets you the bigger capacity 93 kilowatt hour battery as opposed to the 79 kilowatt hour battery. So the range is longer. It's a little bit punchier. It's got more equipment. But it doesn't have that ridiculous over-the-top price tag of the Turbo S. So for me, I'd probably err in the middle and just go for the Turbo.
Well, Marco, that sounds like an excellent wrap for the Taycan. When can we see the review?
I could talk about this car for 10 hours and I'd still have stuff to talk about. Like I said, it's the longest press kit of all time. The review's live now. There's also obviously a detailed pricing and spec breakdown on the site too because if we were to talk about all the features and prices and options and things, this would go on for 4 episodes length of time. So, yeah, head over to carexpert.com and check it out. And obviously, as per always, this was just a launch event. We'll be getting a Taycan or two through the garage very shortly and we'll do proper review video content and longer-term video and review content on it then as well. So, yeah.
Go check it out. Thank you so much, Mike Costello.
Thank you, guys.
Anthony Crawford is here to talk about an opinion piece he's written on the website saying that electric vehicles as daily drivers are getting too fast. Crawf, welcome, and talk us through why you wrote the story.
Yeah, look, I don't think anyone, including myself, is going to sit here and say that I don't like fast cars. I've always loved fast cars. But, you know, with fast cars comes a responsibility too. And we got into a Bugatti Veyron back in 2008. It basically put us on the map at the old place. And we were the first Australians to drive that thing. And I've got to say, even though the drive was lined up by Volkswagen Australia at the time, we had to go through a period where I had to sit in the car with a guy who was the head of tradition for Bugatti, Julius Kruter. And he proceeded to launch that car up to about 350 k's an hour. And I seriously thought, we are not going to make that corner. And I see a tree. And I thought, I literally am going to die here. Like, this is it. And it was terrifying. And I had nausea. I had sickness. And then, of course, he puts you in the car. And, of course, you can't hang about because if you're not capable of going at those speeds and controlling the car, you're out. You're not going to be driving that car. And so I had to actually accelerate. And for the first time in my life, I made myself sick from being behind the wheel, which is quite hard to do. But such are the G-forces in a car like that. Now, let's jump 14 years on, and we've got a Tesla Model S Plaid, they call it, being the top. Well, I think there's a Plaid Plus, but anyway, the Plaid. They both do 0 to 100 in 2.1 seconds. And I thought I'd just Google the acceleration times of a Formula One car. Well, they're anywhere from, in the old days, like 2007, they were down to 1.7 seconds. But the current 2020 Formula One car does it in 2.6. So we're talking about a car that's 0.4 quicker than a Formula One car, which is the pinnacle of high performance and speed. And we're talking about a car that anyone can buy for the likes of, $200,000 on the road, and that can out-accelerate by some margin a Formula One car. Now, if that seems normal, then I'm on the wrong planet because that car should come with some sort of drive it training or a license. Someone in the comments of this article I wrote, this op-ed, said that we're coming towards we need special licenses for cars that can travel at this speed. And I've only centered on Tesla because, you know, there are no other cars period. NA, turbo, supercharged. There are no other cars that can come close to 0 to 100 in 2.1. And that's a family car that can fit luggage and four people. Is there something wrong with that, or am I barking up the wrong tree here? Like, I don't know. Like,
it's, so, Crawf, I suppose it's worth clarifying as well. Like, one of the things that you're saying is not that cars shouldn't be fast, because there's always going to be a place for cars that accelerate really hard and are, you know, are pushing the limits. But it's more that, like, everyday family cars at some point are just going to be too quick. And you look at the Tesla Model 3, for example, and even the slowest one is like a 4.5 second car to 100, something
which
like
is
that.
Very quick. Which is very quick. Yeah.
So, yeah, I suppose it's just worth clarifying that it's not so much that you're not saying cars should be fast, but more maybe we don't need family cars to be this fast, especially at the affordable end, because people can't necessarily handle it.
I'm almost positive they can't handle it, because I know what it's like driving these cars at speed, where we get to drive them on track. And, you know, just at Phillip Island yesterday, I can't tell you how it is, but driving the M3 at 240 Ks down the main straight at Phillip Island, and just a slight break and heading into turn one at 200, it is terrifying. You're never quite sure of is the car going to stick. And I just think acceleration of that level on public streets, where you have a lot of cars around you, racetracks, everyone's going in the same direction. It's the safest place you can be driving quickly. But a public road fraught with traffic lights, and there's so much visual clutter. I actually got booked, I don't mind saying this, a couple of weeks ago, and turning right on a red arrow because I was actually in a van and it was raining and it was early morning and heading to the markets, and I saw green and the nav said, turn right here. Like, he gave me no warning. And I just turned right. I just saw green. There was no one coming in the other direction. And that's visual clutter for you. I was confused and I turned right on a red arrow. I've never done that in my life. I was only traveling at about 10 Ks an hour, but nonetheless, there's visual clutter out there. And if you're doing speed, and if there was someone coming and you were doing, you know, 0 to 100 in 2.1 seconds or 3.3 for the Tesla Model 3, which is affordable to a point, I'd say these days people are spending more on cars. They're leasing cars. So under $100,000 is not above and beyond the means of normal people these days. And that 3.3 seconds is quicker, as we discussed, than a E63 Mercedes, monster car. J-Lo.
Crawf, I'm actually really glad that you started this conversation, because I've sort of touched on this a few times in the past when we've talked about like new model launches and things like that, because obviously we're seeing, as you've said, many, many different car makers making their vehicles extremely fast, and it's, you know, minimizing that 0 to 100 time. It seems to be like a bragging rights thing. And obviously Tesla has sort of taken the lead on that, because some of their cars are ridiculously quick, even at the base level. But like, I've always wondered why. You know, I have, being on the younger side of things, there's a lot of people our age that would, you know, they aspire to own something that's quite fast. And there's a lot of people that will own, like, you know, I have a Golf GTI, which I consider a pretty fast car, like, you know, but people will tell me it's slow because it takes 6 seconds to get to 100. But when you consider the amount of power that cars like that have, it's not about the 0 to 100 times. It's about, like, the amount of power that you've got. And, you know, in Australia, we have such strictly governed speed limits that to need anything that, you know, is as fast as this Tesla, or even anything that's a sub 4 second car, four seconds is bloody fast already. Yeah, 100%. So for anyone that with minimal, you know, driver trait, like I have a lot of friends that I wouldn't consider the best drivers. And I'm sure, Scott, you've got friends that you've gone to school with that you've driven with that would say the same. And these are there are people our age now that, you know, they're on the wrong side of 25 and heading towards 30. They've got a bit of money and they want something expensive. And, you know, an A45, for example, there's a lot of kids running around in those with P plates on them, and they're sub 4 second cars. And I don't know if people can handle that.
I suppose the question then is, what's the solution? Because we are lucky in that we get to drive a lot of cars, but you can't you can't put a price threshold on performance because, like, that's just ridiculous to say if you earn more than this amount of money, you can handle this much car. It's just not how it works.
Mm.
So, like, what do we think the solution is? Because as more electric vehicles hit the market, it's not just Tesla making fast cars. I mean, Lucid, BYD, even the Ford Mustang Mach-E is a quick car at every level. So it seems like performance isn't going to go away. We can't just stop that drive, and we don't really want to, because cars getting better and more performant is a good thing. How do we make it so people can handle it, or how do we make it so that the performance doesn't blow you away?
Okay. Let's go back to a land like Australia or Norway or many other countries. I mean, the only country in the world that offers free speed is Germany on parts of its Autobahn, and they are getting few and far between. They're de-restricted zones that come up, and they generally last for about 10 Ks, and then they're out. Then you're back onto the 130, the 130 speed limit in most of Europe. So we're in Australia, we're 110. You get your license is taken away and your car's taken away if you do a burnout. So if you accelerate fast off the line and the wheels spin and you're seen doing that, there goes your car. They can impound it and you'll lose your license for a year potentially. So why do we need cars that can accelerate that fast? I mean, some of the most enjoyable cars to drive now and some of the most expensive high performance cars like the Singer aren't particularly quick, but they are engaging. And like what J-Wo said about his GTI, 6 seconds is more than enough to scoot around traffic and to scoot past someone and to overtake someone at 100 in 110 zone speed zone. They might not be going away, but I do think the governments need to look at these speed limits and why are they allowing cars in? I mean, you're not allowed to bring a car in with a particular type of headlight because of ADR. Why are you allowed to bring in a car that can do 335 Ks an hour and accelerate from 0 to 100 in the case of the Model X plate, which is an SUV for the family, doing 2.6 seconds, which is as fast as with Albors' Performante, which is a highly, high-speed car for the track. I just think there's something wrong, and I think government should be on the front foot doing something about it before people get killed. And
So what's the cutoff then? Because I think also, like, we as car enthusiasts, and Crawf, I love your reviews because they're very passionate, but in a review of a fast car, you will say this car is fantastic because it's really fast.
Yeah.
So I suppose the two questions are, what's the cutoff and who gets to decide? But also, do we need to rethink how we write about these cars as well? Because I think it is one thing for you to say that at the moment and say, oh, cars are getting too quick, but it's another to then take away the cars that you love because they're fast.
Well, I think just to bring that to the point, yesterday's launch of the M3, M4 was at Phillip Island. So we drove those cars very quickly at Phillip Island, which allowed you to test the dynamic abilities and what they'd done to that car as far as bracing and rigidity goes. So that was cool. I think that's a very responsible act by BMW. And many other car makers launch their cars on track, those fast cars, because obviously you can't do any sort of performance driving or dynamic driving on a public road. Although with a GTI at 0 to 100 in 6 seconds, you can have a lot of fun driving at the speed limit around corners on a mountain pass or a high country road in Victoria. So maybe the cutoff is, I think Moco suggested or someone suggested, 5 seconds, 0 to 100. And if it's any more than that, I think these supercars and all that, just because you have money, certainly doesn't mean you can drive. We see that time and time again where wealthy people get into fast cars on tracks and they go off and hit walls and tire walls. That's very common at performance drive days. And so I think you need a level of driver training if you're going to purchase a car like that. And I think you should have to pass through various levels of driver training. Porsche have a very good system where they have level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, I think, where you've got to pay money. You've got to pay money to educate yourself to understand how that car works and how to deal with that car's performance capabilities. And they do a wonderful job. And you come away thinking you're a much better driver. That doesn't mean you're ready to drive a Bathurst event on your way home. It just means you'll be more responsible. And because the guys that teach you out there, they're very responsible guys, and they understand that you can die in a fast car. And look, yeah. I don't have all the answers. My opinion piece was to offer and bring about and spark discussion. And I think it's important that we have this discussion now before people start dying in fast electric cars. And I think if we leave it till many people have died in Teslas or Han, you posted something the other day on a very fast Chinese car. Was it the Han or something, or that did 0 to 100 in 3.2 or something?
Yeah. Right. So to tie this all together, and at risk of going a little bit away from the initial point of the op-ed, is there maybe something to be said for looking into better driver training for everyone when they get their license, because cars are getting quicker, and also Australia has a pretty poor record with driver training just in general?
100%. People often talk about how difficult it is to get your license and how expensive to get your license it is in Germany. And I think we need to employ much more rigorous driving tests. And I think you should be driving in the rain on freeways. I think you should be driving at night and locking up hours. And I think you should be doing a lot more driver training with, you know, the type of people that teach us when we go to launch events, because these people are exceptional coaches. And I'm not sure the guy that's down at the local RMS or Services New South Wales, I don't know what it is in Melbourne, I'm not sure they're equipped to actually teach people some finer details and give them some good tips about even how to hold the steering wheel. I see people holding the wheel up here. I see people holding one wheel down here with one hand on their thighs. I mean, this is just not how you drive a car. And if something happens in an accident and you've got one hand at the bottom of the wheel, how are you going to steer around an obstacle? You hold it at 9 and 3 or 10 and 2 because it gives you instant muscle reaction if you need to, things like that. There are 100 of those sort of ideas and effects that you're taught when you drive at our level that I think should be passed on to the normal driver licensee. I definitely think people like even Brock when he was alive, Lowndes has been on it. We've all been asking for more driver training, but the powers that be don't seem to think anything. There's obviously no problem, and yet we're still losing, you know, thousands of people a year on the roads. And you know, they say it's always speed, or alcohol. Sure, there's a bit of that, but I tell you what, it's either people not quite competent with the vehicle they're in, or it's the actual roads. And there's another story. Are they spending enough money on building decent roads? Because they look to be quite deplorable in a lot of places in Australia. And, you know, when you pay your registration, it's $67, but $400 that's added is vehicle tax, motor vehicle tax. Where's that money going? In America, that sort of money has to go directly to roads. In Australia, it goes to general coffers. And I think the government is not doing the right thing by its population.
All right, there's a bit to think about there. And we started with electric cars and got to driver training and road funding. But it was a very interesting op-ed, Crawf. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, Scully. Thanks, Joe.
The Subaru Outback is finally in Australia, and Paul Marrick drove 900 kilometres in it to see how its wagon body design stacks up against SUVs. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Mandy. How are you?
Very good, thank you. I checked out your review, which is live now, and you asked the question whether the Outback does everything an SUV does. So does it?
Well, I think so. I honestly don't know what the fascination is with SUVs, because when you look at something like an Outback, it pretty much is an SUV, if we're being honest with ourselves. And it even has more ground clearance than most mid-size SUVs. It's 213 mil. It's got a giant boot, plenty of room inside. You know, I think people just buy an SUV because, I don't know, maybe they feel like they can see more or something like that. What do you guys reckon?
I think it's the ride height as well. You know, maybe for older people who have hip problems or back problems, easy to get in and out. But apart from that and seeing high, that's all I can think of.
I think just everyone's driving them at the moment and people don't want to feel left out. You sort of feel like you're getting less of a car with a hatchback or a sedan, even though you're paying less for the same car usually. But yeah, I know the friends of mine who've looked for SUVs, often it's the case of everyone else has got one, I want one as well.
It was a bit like the other day we had a table tennis tournament at the office and I thrashed Scott and I think he felt left out, which is why he wanted to be
Mandy, if you could just mute Paul anyway. For a second. I lost a ball playing with my wrong hand using the bat handle and he beat me but in quadruple overtime.
Yeah, anyway, back to the Outback.
Back to the Outback.
So, yeah, prices kick off from just under $40,000 before on-road costs. So, it's actually pretty good value for money when you look at what you're getting. And then they go all the way up to just under 48 grand in the Touring, which is the one that we drove. I'm a big fan of what they've done with the interior. I think the exterior kind of feels very much the same, but the interior is really where it's at. They've got a big 11.6-inch infotainment display down the center. It's a portrait display. It's got Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, and it takes up pretty much the entire screen when you have Apple CarPlay running, which is cool. The materials inside the cabin are fantastic. And it's just a really nice and pleasant car to drive. The ride is excellent. It is unfortunately only mated to a 2.5-litre four-cylinder naturally aspirated petrol engine in Australia. We don't get the 2.4-litre turbocharged petrol that they do in the States. So that is a tiny bit disappointing. But for the most part, it has more than enough punch for highway driving. And the ride, I think, is just the most exceptional part about it. It just feels super comfy. So when you are doing sort of long-distance Ks, it really just soaks up the miles.
Does the steering wheel have about 25 buttons on it still?
No, look, they've reduced the buttons. I think there's still about 20 there, but it's a very small departure from that. Just one thing I didn't really love, I noticed with the cruise control, and I've noticed this in a couple of Japanese cars, when I'm going up hills, it'll speed up, it'll race up the hill, it'll reach the peak, and instead of just letting go of the throttle, it just keeps going, and then you go down the hill like 5Ks an hour over the speed limit, and then it just slams the brakes on, and it's just... Ooh. As you're sort of doing the drive that we did from Melbourne to Bright, you're sort of doing that hilly terrain on the Hume, it just really becomes a little frustrating when the car just suddenly zooms past someone and then slows right down. It just wrecks the rhythm of all the other cars around you.
Paulie, the Outback is not a small car, and that 2.5-litre boxer engine, even though they keep improving it, is not a super powerful engine. Does it feel like enough to actually handle an Outback and a family and a load of gear?
Look, it's okay. It's not underpowered. You do need a little bit of a run-up for overtaking and that kind of thing. But for the most part, you can make do with what it's got. I think it just would be so much better if they offered the turbo here. Like, I mean, it would really just complete this and round the package out. At the moment, it feels fine, but just slightly underdone.
Over the 900 Ks you did, Paul, how did you find the fuel economy?
Well, when we were filming it, I'm sort of deceiving people a little bit here. When we were filming, we ended up averaging around 11 litres per 100 Ks. But then when it came to that longer distance drive, we ended up getting it down to 7.5. So I think in and around the city, it was quite hot. The AC was running it. It sort of really was working quite hard. But then on the highway, it really just comes into its own and it cruises along nicely. There was a fair bit of tyre noise, though, on the course chip country roads. So that was a little bit frustrating. But it was a very sort of pleasant experience inside the cabin with an amazing air conditioner.
Did you get a chance to take it off-road at all?
No. We didn't do any off-roading, but it is a permanent all-wheel drive, and I think you can do some light off-roading with it. It's worth keeping in mind you can get aftermarket suspension from, I think Ironman does a kit for it. So if you do need to do anything slightly more serious, you do have options available there.
Paulie, the Outback doesn't really have any direct rival. I know the Skoda Superb Scout is similar in concept, but it's a bit more expensive again. What does this actually go up against, and what do you think the Outback does better or worse than those competitors?
Look, it is really the Superb that it goes up against. We don't really have any other off-road wagons available that aren't super expensive, like your Audi All-Roads and the E-Class All-Terrain.
Don't forget the Passat All-Track, guys.
Yes, the Passat All-Track as well. I forgot about that. But yeah, look, they are the cars that it goes up against. I think this has carved a niche of its own. The rest of those cars simply sit 10, 15 mil higher, whereas this actually has that SUV dimension to its exterior. So this is a bona fide SUV as opposed to just a wagon on stilts. So I think that Subaru has a bit of a cult following in the States where this has become popular, and this is arguably why this car has been able to continue for as long as it has.
Well, Paul, sort of leading on from that answer that you've just given, the Outback and most of Subaru's designs actually of late have changed quite a bit from the stuff that we kind of in Australia grew to love in the 90s and the noughties. Do you still feel that this latest Outback, despite being very American focused, do you still feel it sort of plays to that, to the strengths of the previous generations that would make people here still want to buy them?
I think so. I look at the exterior of this and I think it follows a similar design trend, but you can see where they've gone America on it with things like those wheel arches that just the plastic guards that just go all sorts of different angles. And there are a couple of things like that creep through. But for the most part, this feels like the Outback of old. It is bigger, yes, but it does everything that the old Outback did. It hasn't tried to evolve into something that it's not. And I think for that, they should be given praise.
Do you think it's priced right for what you get?
Look, I think it's actually pretty affordable. It's, I don't know if affordable is the right word, but well-priced. I don't think it's all that expensive when you consider how much an SUV is. Like if you look at something like a Kia Sorento, the GT line, that's what, help me out here, James, like a 60-something $1,000 car.
Yeah, between 60 and 65, depending on whether you get the petrol or the diesel. Yeah.
Yep. And this one's sitting around that 47 mark for the top spec plus on-roads. I mean, it just feels like good value to me when you look at everything that you're getting.
All right. That review is now up at carexpert.com. Paul Marrick, thank you very much.
No, thank you, Mandy.
That is a wrap. Any interesting reviews going live at the site this week, JWO?
Yes, well, by the time everyone hears this episode, they might be a couple of days old, but we've got quite a few launches happening as we speak right now. So as we spoke about before, Mike just reviewed the Porsche Taycan, which will be live, and he also reviewed the updated Lexus LS. And Paul has been driving the latest Hyundai Tucson, which is an all-new car and quite a big deal because that car is a very the current one or the outgoing one is quite popular. So be good to read that and get people's thoughts on the design because it's quite out there in terms of how it looks.
Does that come with a video as well with the Tucson?
Yes, so the Tucson comes with awesome. A video. The other two don't, but yes, Paul's face is all over the video on the Tucson.
Just what we want. What cars have we got visiting our garage next week, Scully?
So down in Melbourne, we've got a Hyundai Palisade with the V6, which will be very interesting. I drove that car on the launch last year, but keen to see how it stacks up in, we'll call it tighter conditions. There's a lot of open road driving on launch, and obviously we live in Melbourne where there is a lot less space. So that'll be interesting. We've also got the Audi SQ7 coming through the office, big turbocharged performance car. And then a big week for Hyundai, actually, i30 sedan and a Kona Highlander. i30 sedan is a new car, and the Kona Highlander has been facelifted recently. It's got a unique new look, so that's also going to be very interesting. Up in Sydney, we have got a RAV4 GXL hybrid. And then in Brisbane, there's a Toyota LC200, the last of the V8 Land Cruisers, we think, at the moment. So sort of getting ready to say goodbye to that car.
I saw one on the road, an older model, yesterday. The guy was obviously so proud of it. He's taken it off-road. He's got all the stickers all over it that has Land Cruiser Prado all over it. Like, well done, you. You obviously are an enthusiast and you're enjoying what the car is meant to be doing. So I sort of was tempted to give him a thumbs up.
He would have looked at the Volkswagen up and gone, what on earth is that?
It has been a pleasure, Scott Colley, James Wong. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.